morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Today is Thursday, May the 19th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. The war in Ethiopia's Tigray region means that more than 1 million children are missing out on school. That is according to the UN.
You see family members, parents, siblings, raped, killed, injured. And a child during the formative years, see all this violence or even are the subject of the violence, will logically become traumatized.
And African countries are being encouraged to use both soft and hard power to counter the growing threat posed by Islamic State on the continent.
While we recognize that there seems to be a similarity at a certain level, in a different way, we see that even the actors involved or the insecurity actors involved, as well as the way they relate with communities.
And the World Health Organization says authorities in Mozambique have declared an outbreak of wild poliovirus type 1. We'll have those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Stay tuned. And for our top story, the United Nations says the war in Ethiopia's Tigray region means more than 1 million children are missing out on school. In neighboring regions, schools are reopening as fighters and displaced people that occupied them leave, but some are dealing with grim challenges while their students face trauma. Henry Wilkins reports from Gashena in Ethiopia.
A total of 1.39 million children in the Tigray region are currently missing out on education due to Ethiopia's civil war, according to the United Nations. While journalists are banned from entering Tigray, VOA was able to access the neighbouring Amhara region, where schools are beginning to reopen after Tigrayan forces that occupied much of the region withdrew in December. But the occupation left deep scars. Residents in the town of Gashena say Tigrayan forces used the classroom as a base, left graffiti on classroom walls, insulting the Amhara ethnic group and Ethiopia's prime minister, and dumped bodies into a mass grave on school grounds. The TPLF has denied such allegations and called for an independent investigation. One of the students, Aiten Mune, recounts returning to the school after the Tigrayan forces had left. He says when he returned to the school, there were bloodstains, broken desks, broken computers here and there. The TPLF had used the school as a hospital, which is why there was so much blood, he explains. The deputy headmaster of the school, Getnet Habtamu, said he had to mobilise local authorities to exhume the mass grave filled with soldiers and civilians killed during the fighting because of the psychological impact it had on students. He said students refused to attend because the school was a total mess and that there was blood all over the place. He adds that the community worked together to bring the students back to school, but teachers had to go door to door to the students' house to convince them to come back. Farther north, near the town of Sokoto, the UN provides schooling for children displaced by the conflict, but many of them, like Batukan Gebrat, have been traumatized from witnessing the fighting. She says her brother was killed in an explosion while he was playing with his friend, and that she has seen many, many bad things. I even saw people killed after having their limbs cut off, she says. Yasmin Sharif, the director of Education Cannot Wait, a UN-funded non-profit, says education can play an essential part in helping children like Batukan and Mune build resilience to trauma. She spoke to VOA over Zoom.
You see family members, parents, siblings, raped, killed, injured, and a child during the formative years. So see all this violence or even are the subject of the violence will logically become traumatized. And that's why mental health and psychosocial services are another very existential, life-saving component of education.
She adds, while food security and access to water are essential to people displaced by war, education is also essential in the long term if countries are to build back effectively and avoid future conflict. For the nearly 1.4 million students entering their third school year disrupted by war in Tigray, the consequences will likely be felt for the rest of their lives. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ethiopia.
African countries are being encouraged to use both soft and hard power to counter the growing threat posed by Islamic State on the continent. The U.S. government is giving more than $100 million to African states to overcome terrorism. As Mohammed Yusuf reports, top U.S. security officials say African leadership and voices are needed to ensure security assistance is targeted to where it is needed the most.
Last week, security leaders from the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS pledged to support African security agencies in dealing with the terrorist activities of the Islamic State. The coalition, which has 85 members, met in Morocco to discuss ways of dislodging fighters allied to ISIS from Mali, Burkina Faso, Mozambique and several other African countries. Terror activities by these militants have increased in recent years, killing tens of thousands and displacing millions, creating a humanitarian crisis. Chris Landberg is a State Department's acting principal deputy coordinator for counterterrorism. Landberg says some African governments will receive millions of dollars to improve their efforts in fighting terrorism.
So we are increasing this every year, and we're looking to use it to improve capabilities of our partner, civilian law enforcement and judiciary, with goals of disrupting, apprehending, prosecuting and convicting terrorists across the continent.
Akinola Olojo, a senior researcher at the Institute for Security Studies, says the ISIS affiliates in Africa are different from each other and will require tailored strategies to defeat them.
While we recognize that there seems to be a similarity at a certain level, in a different way, we see that even the actors involved or the insecurity actors involved, as well as the way they relate with communities and the way they sort of act against the states, takes different expressions. And we need to understand these nuances in order to have approaches that can adequately match what is manifesting in the different contexts.
The Deputy Special Envoy for the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS, Doug Hoyt, said countering the militants' messaging is critical.
So the coalition itself will probably continue to launch platforms against what we see as the vulnerable youth, certainly in the Sahara and the in the Sahel and Trans-Sahara region. So what we're emphasizing with communications is it's not top down, it's bottom up. So we start at the local level and we work with member governments and we tailor these messaging in language and customs and traditions and what's going on here. We very much want the African members out front on that.
The UN Global Counterterrorism Strategy, an instrument meant to enhance the international effort to counter terrorism, calls for nations to address the conditions terror groups use to spread terrorism. It also aims at building the state's capacity to prevent and combat terrorism while adopting measures to respect human rights and the rule of law. Olojo says African security agencies were encouraged to use different ways to tackle terrorism apart from the usual military response.
Hard responses have a role to play, of course. But then going beyond this to address governance gaps, for instance, addressing the ideology pushed by these affiliates, addressing issues of human rights violations, engaging communities more deeply or more, you know, effectively, having dialogue on several levels within communities. I think all these, you know, components are things which obviously are highlighted, you know, at these meetings. And then we see how they sort of fit into a broad approach.
U.S. officials say the lessons used to weaken ISIS in Iraq and Syria can be applied in Africa, but will need individuals present on the continent to get results. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Daybreak Africa continues. The World Health Organization says authorities in Mozambique have declared an outbreak of wild poliovirus type 1 after confirming that a child in the country's northeastern Tete province has contracted the disease. It becomes the second case of wild poliovirus confirmed in southern Africa this year, following a case in Malawi in mid-February. Columbus Mavunga reports from Zimbabwe, one of the five countries where the WHO says It will conduct mass vaccinations and will strengthen surveillance against the disease.
In a statement, Dr. Machidiso Moeti, the World Health Organization Regional Director for Africa, called the outbreak of poliovirus in Mozambique greatly concerning. She added that efforts were underway to help strengthen disease surveillance in Malawi, Mozambique, Tanzania, Zambia, and Zimbabwe, with plans to reach 23 million children ages 5 and below with polio vaccine in the coming weeks. Dr. Ndutabe Mojurum is the interim polio program coordinator for the WHO Africa region. First step, he says, is to carry out a quality vaccination campaign.
The second measure is to reinforce the surveillance in all our countries so that they will be able also to detect very, very quickly all polioviruses circulating in our region. You have to extend to the other countries the measure of the surveillance, so that the measure we have to take very, very quickly to address this situation.
Dr. Nomeni Matara, the head of the Zimbabwe Association for Doctors for Human Rights, says the outbreaks of disease may have resulted from the lockdowns that the world went through while fighting COVID-19.
You know, with the pandemic, the lockdowns and clinics shutting down, there is a probability that some infants and children might have missed their immunizations schedule, and thus we now have these emergence of outbreaks, measles in Zimbabwe and now polio in part of Mozambique. So we really urge the government that as they fight COVID-19, we should intensify also the immunization of children, especially in those neglected areas, so that every children gets immunized. We also urge the government to implement strong surveillance systems.
Last week, Zimbabwe declared an outbreak of measles in a province on the border with Mozambique. President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government said it was working with the WHO to immunize children in the whole country. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
Nigerian authorities Wednesday say the death toll from a gas explosion that led to the collapse of a building in northern Kano State has risen to 9. Members of the National Emergency Management Agency, NEMA, carried out rescue operations on the site of the blast. Timothy Obiezu reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
The NEMA head in Kano, Nura Abdullahi, told VOA that the rescue operations came to an end Tuesday evening. Abdullahi said injured were hospitalized and said two have so far been discharged. Authorities said a gas cylinder explosion near a welder's shop in Sabongeri area caused the building to collapse Tuesday morning. The explosion affected a nearby nursery and primary school where students were in class. In a viral video posted on social media, young pupils with blood stains on their uniforms were taken from a school near the explosion site. Local residents challenged the official explanation, saying the explosion was caused by a bombing. State Commissioner of Police Samaila Shuaibudiko visited the site with explosive disposal teams and rejected the claims in a televised interview.
We had to rush down with our experts. You know, if you can see, they said it was an explosion, bomb explosion, but sincerely, it's not bomb explosion. And I want to emphasize that it is gas cylinder explosion.
Sabongeri is mostly populated by people who moved to Kano from elsewhere. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The 9th session of the AfriCities Summit, which is the largest democratic gathering organized in Africa, began in Kisumu, Kenya, this week. Over 8,000 dignitaries from across the world are attending the 5-day conference, including former and incumbent presidents and officials from the United Nations and the African Union. Atieno Odhiambo has more.
For the first time ever, an intermediary city, Kisumu, has hosted the AfriCities Summit. The conference, which started on Tuesday, will end on Saturday. The theme for the meeting is the role of intermediary cities of Africa in the implementation of Agenda 2030 of the United Nations and the African Union Agenda 2063. The conference has brought over 8,000 delegates across the world to the Lakeside City to deliberate on the role of the intermediary cities on the continent. President Uhuru Kenyatta, while presiding over the official opening, called for tangible, practical, and sustainable solutions to the challenges facing Africa's urban centers.
The need for proper urban planning was clearly demonstrated during the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic, when it became necessary to support those living in informal settlements in our cities and urban areas with food rations, as well as the provision of sanitary facilities. So, ladies and gentlemen, the challenge of our time is therefore to make our intermediary cities and municipalities sustainable and fit for all our citizens. Accordingly, this summit has the task of providing the continent with a comprehensive and achievable roadmap on how our intermediary cities can contribute towards the implementation of the agenda.
Several dignitaries attended the summit, including African Union Commission Chairperson His Excellency Moussa Faki. He cited the summit theme regarding the role of intermediary cities in Africa in implementing the Agenda 2030 of the United Nations and the African Union 2063. Faki said that their responsibilities need to be recognized and clarified.
The growth of intermediary cities implies an increase in wealth, inequalities, need for housing, infrastructure and urban services, pollution, need for decent jobs, and therefore the role needs to be recognized and clarified. If left alone to manage themselves without a clear role, cities will manifest into chaotic development. Cities have their unique challenges and potentials. Therefore, clarification of their role should take into consideration their peculiarities.
Former Kenyan Prime Minister Raila Odinga, in his capacity as the African Union High Representative for Infrastructure, chaired the first roundtable discussion made up of the current and former heads of state. Odinga said that in order to prepare for growing urbanization, Africa needs to invest in energy generation and infrastructure development.
Africa has got 1 billion people, meaning that we are not fully prepared for our urbanization, which is going to come whether we like it or not. So we need, therefore, to invest more in energy generation as well. We are planning also to construct 19 new ports on the continent, also about 20 new airports, improving the air transport in the continent. Africa has a need for more investment in infrastructure development.
This is the second time within a decade that the summit has been held in Kenya. AfriCities is the flagship for the group United Cities and Local Governments of Africa. The meeting is held every 3 years in one of the 5 regions of the continent. The 2 major objectives include defining appropriate shared strategies to improve living conditions at the local level, as well as contribute to the integration, peace, and unity of Africa, starting from the grassroots. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
Now, even though the global COVID-19 pandemic is not yet officially over, life in many parts of the world is slowly returning to normal, as many governments continue relaxing or lifting pandemic-related restrictions. Studies show that due to restrictions like lockdowns and quarantines, many communities are dealing with increased depression, anxiety, distress, and other mental health challenges that are making it difficult for them to achieve a state of happiness or wellness. Melanie Edwards is an award-winning singer, songwriter, and multi-instrumentalist based in the Washington, D.C. area. Melanie recently launched a series of musical mending workshops to help people cope with grief, anxiety, depression, and other mental health conditions. She tells me that music has always played an important role in helping people heal collectively.
I think music is more important now than it's ever been, because coming out of a pandemic where we've been isolated and struggling with all these challenges, it's a new way to connect that provides a forum of unity. What I mean by that is, before the pandemic, we may have felt even isolated within our communities in different ways. Now everybody is going through a collective experience and everyone's challenged under the same guise. The music pulls everybody out of those isolation zones and brings back a way to converse, to express, to enjoy, to experience life. Everybody loves a concert. Everybody loves to get together and sing around a campfire. People are all creative in that capacity. And music is the channel and a conduit to the other side. It's a way that we can all bring community back into a place where we can find commonality. I've just started working more in the realms of music as a healing modality. I've been a performer and a singer-songwriter on the stage for 28 years, but there has been something inside of me that has wanted to bring out more music as a service. And so I've developed this new way to try to help folks creatively cope using musical mending skills. I've always thought, and I still think today, that music and the art and creativity is not a gift, it's a birthright, that all of us have this natural ability to create.
Since the beginning of this year, millions of people around the world have returned to work and children are going back to school. Many more are looking forward to getting out of their isolation and the return to social gathering events like concerts. However, as the pandemic-weary public begins what has been described as a new normal, many are still dealing with the negative impact the pandemic has had on their mental health.
One of the things about music that I think most resonates with me is its ability to unify and unite all of us globally. It is a language that is universal. Everyone knows music and everyone can relate to it. Everyone speaks music. And so when we're playing music in any art form, really, we're able to bring these portals and these new ways of life together as one.
Mental health experts have always pointed to the benefits of music therapy to treat various forms of mental health conditions, including depression and anxiety. Melanie says that music is a medium for processing emotions, trauma, and grief, and can be used to heal the mind.
There is proof that when we have music and dance and movement, music and movement pull out trauma. That ability to primarily get into these places where things are stored, it's a way out, a channel out. Because we can talk about things in a way that may not be direct. And health doesn't help. Mental health is not just a linear way. It's cyclic. You can heal in a cycle like a circle. And music is like that. It's vibrational, it's sonic, it's not direct line. And so by doing dancing and movement and music and these art forms, we're able to get these traumas out and collectively unify.
Melanie, who is about to embark on her first trip to Africa, says that since we all as a global family suffer together, we can use music as a shared language to heal together.
We are going to Africa for the first time. We're going to start in Zanzibar, and then we're going to go into the Serengeti for a safari, and then to Masai Mara in Kenya. And one of the greatest daydreams and one of the biggest hopes that I've had, and I really hope it can manifest, I've always wanted to have an African choir behind my music, behind one of my songs, just kind of this filling of the space of just beautiful, gorgeous music and voices together. So I'm going to put that out into the universe that, you know, hopefully that can manifest. But if not, I'm just really looking forward to the travels and the new experiences and then being able to bring that back and compose and make some albums out of that.
And that's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voanews.com. And remember to connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and on YouTube, where you can watch our videos. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great week ahead, Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports, or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.